ब्रह्मादिभ्यो ब्रह्मविद्यासंप्रदायकर्तृभ्यो वंशर्षभ्यो महद्भ्यो नमो गुरुभ्यः श्रुतिस्मृतिपुराणानामालयं करुणालयं नमामि भगवत्पारं शंकरं लोकशंकरं सराशिवसमारंभां शंकराचार्यमध्यमां अस्मराचार्यपर्यन्तां वंदे गुरुपरंपरां शंकरं शंकराचार्यं केशवं बाररायणं सूत्रभाष्यकृतौ वंदे भगवन्तौ पुनः पुनः सर्ववेदान्तसिद्धान्तगोचरं तमगोचरं गोविंदं परमानंदं सद्गुरुं प्रणतोऽस्म्यहम्। Oh, very good. Welcome back. We will continue where we left off in our study of Vaikutha Chudamani. We're coming near the end now. We've finished that very heavy, important part of the text, concluding with the Mahavakya, after our study of the Tatpara, the Tvampara, and finally Asi. And now the current subject matter we started in the last class is the Jnana Pala, the fruits of these teachings. And we're seeing a series of verses describing the nature of a Jivan Mukta. Jivan Mukta is one who is Mukta, freed, liberated, Jivan, while living. And it virtually means the same, as we discussed in the last class, means the same as Sthita Prajna, the term used in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And just to reflect briefly on something we discussed last week, it's very important that we understand properly the nature of a Jivan Mukta, the nature of a Sthita Prajna, because it turns out that our naive notions of the nature of an enlightened person, those naive notions can often become obstacles. After all, the enlightened person represents the goal. And if the goal we are seeking is not properly understood, you can imagine the consequence for our journey. As we said in the last class, if the destination is incorrectly known, what will be the nature of your journey? In the same way, if the nature of a Jivan Mukta is not properly understood, it can also distort the nature of our journey. So this is why we see the series of verses on the Jivan Mukta. In particular, we have a series of three verses that we start with this evening. Three verses talking about one particular quality of the Jivan Mukta. There are many, but one is singled out here by Sri Shankara because it's a central feature, it's a key feature. And the feature we can call samatvam. In fact, that very term comes in Bhagavad Gita in a different context. Here, samatvam, usually translated as equanimity. But can we say equanimity to the nth degree, which means not ordinary equanimity. Nor ordinary equanimity means if there's a little problem, you don't care. If there's a medium problem, you try not to care. If there is a big problem, you freak out, as they say in American English. That's the conventional kind of equanimity. We're talking about a very complete, absolute equanimity here. Samatvam means equanimity, but when we use that word with reference to the enlightened person, we're talking about that absolute kind of equanimity. Okay, that's enough introduction. Let us proceed. Guna-dhosha-vishishtesmin, guna-dhosha-vishishtes, svabhavena-vilakshane, svabhavena-vilakshane, sarvatra-samadarshitvam, sarvatra-samadarshitvam, jivan-muktasya-lakshanam, jivan-muktasya-lakshanam, samadarshitvam, jivan-muktasya-lakshanam, So the lakshana here, the quality or characteristic, jivanmuktasya, of a jivanmukta, of one who is enlightened, the characteristic we're describing now, or Sri Shankara is describing now, is samadarshitvam, which means exactly the same as samatvam. That kind of equanimity, again, not the relative equanimity, the absolute equanimity. And you can see how that's described here. First of all, it's samatvam sarvatra, literally everywhere, and that means in all situations, which means not just when you're confronted by a small problem, which means for the big problem and the medium problem as well, sarvatra. But what really distinguishes it is what he says in the first line here. Guna dosha vishishte asmin, so bhavena lakshane, vilakshane, asmin, here, in this world, which is vilakshane, in this world which is has many differences, different situations, different conditions that we encounter every day. In a single day, how many different situations do you encounter? Countless. And subhavena, naturally, this is the way the world is, subhavena, due to the very nature of the world, this world is vilakshana, has all these various differences, and the differences are guna dosha vishishta. The differences in the various situations are vishishta. They're characterized as guna and dosha. Here, guna means that which is desirable. Dosha means that which is undesirable. So to paraphrase that first line, the world in which we live can be characterized as being composed of different things that are either guna, pleasing to us, or dosha, unpleasing to us. And isn't that typically how we look at the world? We divide up the world into things we like and things we don't like. The world has, and of course things we're neutral towards as well. But think of the people in your life. In your mind, you have a list. You won't admit to it, but there's a list. There's a long list of all the people you like, and there's a shorter list. Hopefully, it's a shorter list. I'm sure it's a shorter list of the people that you don't like. This is so common. We look at the world and we categorize the world and the people therein. We categorize the world in terms of what is pleasing to us and what is displeasing to us. Why? Because of our programming. We are programmed to seek that which is beneficial to us and to avoid that which is harmful to us. I think Professor Darwin, 100-some years ago, had many things to say about this. Survival instinct. Absolutely. But we've discussed, I think, long ago in this very text, that it's time for us to outgrow the survival instinct. We're not a bunch of cavemen running around in a savanna trying to run away from lions and tigers and fighting with our neighbors. So to outgrow the survival instinct means to recognize that you are already full and complete exactly as you are, and since that is so, what out there in the world is truly beneficial to you? If you're already full and complete, what can be beneficial to that which is perfect and full? And similarly, what can be a guna and dosha are the words used here. What can be guna, beneficial, dosha, harmful? What can be harmful to you if you are the same, unchanged, no matter what? Obviously, we're not talking about body and mind, but we've been discussing this for a long, long time now. So we're discussing your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, an Atma which is non-different from Brahman, the reality of the cosmos. When you understand your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, how can anything be viewed as beneficial or harmful to you? So, when you get rid of that sense of anything being beneficial or harmful to you, in the absence of that sense, what remains is what we call samatvam, samadarshitva here in this verse. So samatvam, the absolute equanimity we're talking about in this verse and the next two verses, the absolute equanimity is the result of knowing there is nothing beneficial to you in the world, there is nothing harmful to you in the world. That includes people. No person can be of benefit, let's be very clear. No person can make your Satchidananda Atma more than what it is. No person can make Satchidananda less than what it is. No situation, no illness, no lottery ticket, good and bad, whatever it is, Satchidananda Atma remains full and complete under all circumstances. The recognition of this is the samatvam, the absolute samatvam, and this is a Jivan Mukta Lakshana. Just one more, coming back to that Jivan Mukta one more time. You get the sense already that what characterizes the enlightened person is not the enlightened person's behavior. We discussed that very briefly in the last class, where we joked about Arjuna's question at the end of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Sthita prajnasya ka bhasha, sthita dhi kim prabhasheta. How does he sit? How does he walk? How does he talk, the enlightened person? And we discussed then, we'll remind you now, that what characterizes an enlightened person is not the person's behavior, obviously. What characterizes the enlightened person is how the mind works. Now, there is a connection between mind and behavior. We're going to see that, I think, more in the next verse. The connection is this. What is it that motivates your behavior? So what motivates a behavior of an ordinary person is raga and dvesha. What motivates the behavior of an ordinary person is get that which is beneficial, avoid that which is harmful. Get the food that's out there on the savanna, going back to our caveman thing, get the food and avoid the wild animals. This is a basic thing. This is raga dvesha, which is the motivation for conventional behavior. Then what is it that motivates an enlightened person? That motivation is utterly different. That motivation is born of an enlightened mind, and we'll see more of that in the next verse. Ishta nishtarta samprapto, ishta nishtarta sam. Samadharshita yatmani, samadharshita ya ubhayatra vikaritvam, ubhayatra vikar, jivan muktasya lakshanam, jivan muktasya. So here, the jivan muktasya lakshanam, the lakshana, the quality, the characteristic, jivan muktasya of the enlightened person. What is it that characterizes the enlightened person here? Is avikaritvam. Vikara is change. Avikara, absence of change. Avikaritvam is the nature of a person who is unchanging. A person who is unchanging, ubhayatra, in both situations. In both situations, in what situations? Ishta, anishta, artha, samprapto. Samprapto, when you obtain artha, things, when you attain things which are ishta, desirable, or anishta, undesirable, obtaining things that are desirable and undesirable, ubhayatra, in both situations, avikaritvam, the nature of being unchanging, that unchanging nature where atmani, literally in oneself, in one's mind. So that unchanging nature of the mind, a mind not being disturbed, a mind that is undisturbed. If you get what you want, if you don't get what you want, ubhayatra, in both situations, a mind, atmani, Atma here is mind. A mind which is avikaritvam, which has avikaritvam, a mind which is undisturbed in both situations. Why? Samadarshitaya. Same word we saw in the previous verse. Due to the nature of having equanimity, sarvadarshi is seeing everything the same. Sarvadarshitva, the nature of seeing everything the same. One who has that nature of looking upon everything as the same, the one who, obtaining what is desirable or not obtaining what is not desirable or not obtaining what is desirable, ubhayatra, in both cases, the person who is avikaritvam, unchanged in both situations. That's the samadarshana. Let's be very clear about this. So, does that mean you give the person some milk, they drink it, give the person some poison, they drink it? I mean, it's all the same, right? Is this the samadarshana? Let's be very clear. What we're describing here, the enlightened person is free from raga and dvesha, right? The enlightened person is not free of common sense. So, if you drink milk, it has a certain effect on the body. If you drink poison, it has a very different effect on the body. Do you think an enlightened person probably understands that? So, the enlightened person is free from raga dvesha. The enlightened person is not free from common sense. The enlightened person is objective, which we'll talk about in the next verse. And this sense of being unaffected, that's the key word in this verse, the avikaritvam. And the beautiful expression that we see in the Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures, apuryamana achala pratishtam samudram apa pravishanti sarve. It goes on to the second half. This is verse 70 of the second chapter, and talks about just as the samudra, the ocean, with sarve apaha, all the waters, pravishanti, are entering into that ocean. Apuryamanam, the ocean is constantly being filled by all the rivers emptying into the ocean, and that ocean is achala pratishtam. It is established in a state of being unchanging. Simply put, it is unchanging, avikaritvam. The ocean has that avikaritvam, that unchanging nature. No matter how much water flows into the ocean, the level remains the same. And similarly, and you know that water is constantly evaporating from the oceans, right? So no matter how much water evaporates from the oceans, the water level remains unchanged. Just to give a silly example that children would enjoy, if you go to the water and actually there's a, what is it? I forget the mythological story. Some rishi emptied the ocean a drop at a time. I forget the story. We have to look that up. But do you really think so? I mean, it's a story. It comes in some Purana. I don't even remember where it comes. It's very vague in my mind. If you go to the ocean with a teaspoon, and start emptying out the water with a teaspoon, what will happen? Okay, teaspoon is too small. How about a 1 gallon bucket? 5 gallon bucket? 80 gallon drum? 1,000 gallon container? Whatever you use, the level of the water is not going to go down. Similarly, no matter how much water you can add to the ocean, it's not going to increase. Why? It's clear to us all. The analogy of the ocean. The vastness of the ocean is such that its level is unchanging in all situations. Here, we're talking about the vastness of your true self. The vastness of Satchidananda Atma. After all, an Atma which has no edge, no boundary, no limit, how vast is that? It is literally all-pervasive. Not even the ocean is all-pervasive. Atma is all-pervasive, full, complete, limitless. Therefore, that which is vast, like the ocean, that which is all-pervasive and limitless, has this avikaritvam, this nature of being unchanged in any and all situations. The enlightened one, the Jivanmukta, is one who abides in that unchanging condition. The mind becomes imperturbable by all these external situations. We'll see more about that actually in a couple of verses. All right, then. These verses are fairly simple. We can move through them more quickly until they get more difficult again. But right now they're simple. Sadhu bhi pujyamane smin. Sadhu bhi pujyamane. Pijyamane pidurjanaihi. Pijyamane pi. Samabhavo bhavedyasya. Samabhavo. Sajivan mukta lakshanaha, sajivan mukta lakshanaha, sahajivan mukta lakshanaha. That is the lakshana, the characteristic of the jivan mukta. What is the characteristic of a jivan mukta? Samabhavaha. Same word, almost the same word. It's a synonym. So samadarshitva is a word that's been come in the prior two verses. Samatva is a word we borrow from the Bhagavad Gita. And here, samabhava, they're all synonyms. They mean the same. They all mean sama. Sama means same. Samabhavaha. So this condition of equanimity, absolute equanimity, saha, that state of equanimity is jivan mukta lakshanaha. That's the condition that characterizes the enlightened person. So this samabhavaha bhavet, it exists yasya for one. For whom? For whom does the samatva exist? It exists for one who, on the top line, pujyamane asmin. Asmin pujyamane. When this person is being honored, sadhu bihi, by good people, when this jivan mukta is being honored and praised by good people, and you'd think so. Jivan Mukta should be honored and praised by good people. But what about the not-so-good people? So the good people can recognize a saint, let us say. Good people can recognize a saint. What about the other people? The durjana is a word that comes here. Sadhu means here a good person. Durjana means the other kind of person. Durjana literally means a bad person. So durjanaihi, by those other people, the same person is pidyamana, pidyamane asmin, when this person is being afflicted by bad people. So how does this affect the enlightened person? When the enlightened person is praised by good people, what will be the response of the enlightened person? Will the enlightened person get all puffed up with pride? Oh, thank you. Oh, yes. I'm so enlightened. I'm glad you realize how enlightened I am. It's like, how do you praise the ocean? Oh, ocean, you're so vast. The ocean is more vast than you can appreciate. Can you see with your eyes the vastness of the ocean? You have no sense. You have a very partial understanding of the vastness of the ocean. So if you praise the ocean, O ocean, thou art so vast. If the ocean were thinking, the ocean would think, okay. That's your opinion. Whatever it is, your appreciation of vastness. Similarly, If you were to somehow curse the ocean, I don't know why you'd want to curse the ocean, but if you are a durjana, a bad person, you might, for whatever reason, curse the ocean. Why would the ocean care about your curse? The ocean remains vast in spite of your cursing. Does your cursing reduce the vastness of that ocean at all? So, a favorite expression of my guru, Pujya Swami Dayananda, is to say that an enlightened person is objective. And that sounds like such an ordinary word in this context. It turns out it's not as ordinary as you think. Just as we're talking about samatvam to the nth degree, not ordinary samatvam, but absolute samatvam, let's talk about objectivity, not conventional objectivity, but objectivity to the nth degree, absolute objectivity. What does that mean? Objectivity to me means to see things exactly as they are without superimposing your opinion on them, because that's what is subjectivity. When you superimpose your own likes and dislikes on something, that's subjectivity. The example we've used many times, you go into a restaurant, there are many items on the menu, and you wonder which is good and which is bad. Well, that's a superimposition of your likes and dislikes. I guarantee you, every item on that menu is edible, right? Every item, without exception, I guarantee you, edible. Yeah, good, you go to a restaurant with me, you can imagine what... Swamiji, what do you think is good to eat? I say, oh, this one is edible, that one's also edible, this item's edible. In fact, all the items on this menu, they're all edible. That's subjectivity. That's the refusal to superimpose our own individual likes and dislikes on a list of food products, which is what it is. This is objectivity. Now, to be objective towards food, in fact, isn't that interesting? Food is such an ordinary thing. How easy is it to be objective towards food? Most people have very distinct likes and dislikes with regard to foods. And food is such an ordinary, even trivial thing. All you need is 2,000 calories a day to keep your body going. So who cares what form it comes in? You care. Everyone seems to care. But for the enlightened person, calories are calories. It keeps the body going. Shankara uses this lovely expression that he calls food bhikshaushadham in the sadhana panchakam. He says food is the aushadha, it is the medicine in the form of bhiksha, alms, which is used to get rid of the roga, the illness of hunger. For the illness of hunger, you require the medicine in the form of food. When you go to the pharmacy, do you ask the pharmacist for a good-tasting medicine? You want the medicine, not because it tastes good. You want the medicine because it gets rid of the illness. Well, the term is kshut roga, the roga, the illness of kshut, of hunger. So for that illness, the proper treatment, the proper medicine is food. That is objectivity. If you could look, as Shankaracharya describes in a beautiful hymn, Sadhana Panchakam, if you could look at all kinds of food as medicine for the hunger that ails you, and without distinguishing between different kinds of food, without superimposing things that you think are tastier or things that you think are less desirable, if all food is medicine, this is the kind of objectivity an enlightened person has. Food is food. Now, if there's a choice, if there are two kinds of food side by side, do you think the enlightened person, let's construct an experiment. There are two kinds of food side by side. We put an enlightened person in front of both kinds of food and find out which is chosen. There's one food that is really delightful and another food which is really terrible. Which food will the enlightened person choose? Now, you might be thinking, well, maybe it's 50-50. If you do this test enough times, you see that the enlightened person will choose one half the time and choose the other half the time. Wait a minute, we're forgetting one thing. We said, and we've already said this, the enlightened person is free from raga dvesha. The enlightened person is not free from common sense. It applies here also. And that is, the tongue has certain likes and dislikes of its own. If a tasty food is available, go for it. If a tasty food is not available, then what can you do? The enlightened person has that objectivity. Objectivity means also recognizing that milk is milk and poison is poison. Objectivity means recognizing certain foods are well prepared and tasty, certain foods are not. That's objectivity. But objectivity absolutely means the total, complete absence of raga and dvesha. And please remember our definitions of raga, dvesha. We use the term, to use my guru's term, binding likes and binding dislikes, which means a binding like is a desire whose non-fulfillment makes you suffer, or you feel some sense of loss or lack. And a binding dislike is a situation in which if you are stuck with it, you suffer. This is the cause for samsara. This is the cause for worldly suffering. And what's described here is the utter absence of that binding like and dislike, utter absence of this raga dvesha. That is the samabhava. Again, it's the absence of raga dvesha. It's not the absence of common sense. You get that very well. Okay. This then concludes our discussion of the Jivan Mukta. And we still have a couple of verses, several more verses. We're still talking about the fruits of enlightenment, the jnana pala. What is the result of this knowledge, when this knowledge from tattvamasi goes in, what is the result? So we've just talked in the past three verses. One result is this absolute samatvam, complete and perfect equanimity. Now, what else? How else can we understand the fruits, the benefit of this knowledge? We'll see that in the next verse.
Vijnata brahma tattvasya Vijnata brahma tat yatha purvam na samsritihi yatha purvam na asti chena sa vijnata asti chena sa vijnata brahma bhavo bahir mukaha brahma bhavo Vijnata brahma tattvasya yatha purvam na samsritihi.
Na samsritihi. Samsriti is a synonym for samsara. And samsara is perhaps best translated as life of suffering. Samsara simply means that which goes on. But that which goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on, the sense of endless rebirths into a life of difficulty, that's a sense of samsara, the literal meaning. So the general meaning that we can use, a life of suffering. Samsara, or here called samsriti. Here, na samsriti. There is no life of suffering, yatha purvam, as there used to be a life of suffering. There is no suffering for whom? Vijnata brahma tattvasya, for one for whom brahma tattva, the truth of Brahman, the reality of Brahman, is vijnata, known, understood, fully appreciated. Brahma Tattva, the reality of Brahman, is vijnata, known completely. Enlightened person. So, vijnata Brahma Tattvasya, for that person for whom Brahman is fully known, which means for that enlightened person, na samsrutihi, there is no worldly suffering, yatha purvam, as it used to be. Which means the enlightened person before gaining Brahma Jnanam suffered, and after gaining Brahma Jnanam, the suffering comes to an end. Now this sounds very obvious. Before Brahma Jnanam, you're a samsari, you're a worldly person stuck in this world, grasping for moments of happiness, running away from moments of sadness, etc. Definitely there is suffering. And after gaining Brahma Jnanam, that suffering comes to an end. Asti chet. But suppose someone who thinks they have Brahma Jnanam, someone who thinks that they are enlightened, asti chet, suppose there is samsruti, suppose there is suffering. Suppose one who claims to have gained Brahma Jnanam, suppose they continue to suffer. It happens all the time. There are, and I don't want to sound sarcastic or mention names, but there are those who hold themselves to be enlightened and go on complaining about every little thing. That happens. And sometimes, you know, without naming names, a great, great Vedantic scholar I met in Rishikesh many years ago, highly regarded, in fact, this is kind of like the number one scholar in all of Rishikesh at that time, he's no more. But this guy was a little intimidating, mean. You got near him, you didn't feel comfortable. His students really were afraid of him. No one found him especially pleasant. What's going on? How is it possible that you could spend a life, decades immersed in this Vedantic study, and still as mean and ornery as ever? And if he's mean and ornery to others, I suppose you're thinking, well, he's causing suffering for others. Maybe he's not suffering. But that's probably not the case, right? If you're mean and ornery and making others suffer, probably you are also suffering, would be a good guess. So, how is that possible? The expression you may have heard me use before is, how can someone study Vedanta for decades and emerge unscathed? And it happens. And that's what's being described here. Asti chet, if that worldly suffering continues, then saha, then that person, na vijnata brahma bhavaha, then that person is not one whose bhava, whose state or condition is one of brahma vijnata brahma, is not one whose condition is of having discovered Brahman. Now, what is being said here? It sounds a little bit contradictory. First line says, one who has discovered Brahman is freed from suffering. Second line begins and says, if that person is not freed from suffering, then they haven't discovered Brahman. So it's a little tricky here. What does it mean to... Vijnata literally means known. One for whom Brahman is known, vijnata brahma. What does it mean to know Brahman? Well, if you studied Taittiriya Upanishad, you know that Brahman is satyam jnanam anantam. This is the definition that comes in Taittiriya Upanishad. If you read that Upanishad and you know that Brahman is satyam jnanam anantam, are you enlightened? That's not knowing Brahman. That's knowing about Brahman. That's knowing what the Taittiriya Upanishad teaches about Brahman. That's a kind of knowledge which is abstract, which is conceptual, at best theoretical. That's not the knowledge we're talking about. The knowledge we're talking about through, and we've had this discussion several times before, the knowledge we're talking about is knowledge which is completely consistent with your experience, knowledge which is in the first person, which means refers to I, refers to yourself, which means to know Brahman means to know yourself as Brahman. The Jnata Brahma Bhava is the condition of knowing Brahman as the consciousness by which this experience is known. That's what it means to know Brahman. That is what is called here Vijnata Brahma Bhava. But it certainly is possible to know about Brahman, that Brahman is Satyam Jnanam Anantam. It's possible to study Vedanta for years and decades. It's possible to study many Upanishads. There are 10 major Upanishads. You can study them all. You can study them with Shankara's commentaries. You can study the Bhagavad Gita with Shankara's commentaries. You can study the Brahma Sutra with Shankara's commentaries and then all the sub-commentaries. You can study all the works of Shankara, Vidyaranya, of all these great Vedantic scholars. You can become a great pundit, a great scholar of Vedanta, and still not recognize your own true nature as Brahman. And that's what's being described here. In the absence of discovering your own true nature as Brahman, you remain, one remains, bahirmukha. Bahirmukha literally means extrovert. One extrovert, one whose mukha, whose face, whose orientation is bahihi, is outside. One who looks outside. One who looks outside, why? Because you're chasing after what you want and you're running away from what you don't want. This is a raga dvesha. This is a survival instinct that we talked about before. You will remain bahir mukaha, extrovert and dependent on the world around you for happiness. You'll remain such until and unless you really get it. So really getting it is not a matter of scholarship. It's not a matter of studying all these complicated texts. It's not a matter of being highly intelligent. Let's take just a moment to reflect on this. Is it necessary to be highly intelligent to discover your true nature as Satchidananda Atma? It is nature to be highly intelligent to study, to appreciate some of these teachings. I don't deny that. A few of the verses that we hit in this chapter were pretty, in this text, were pretty demanding. And unless you have all your, what is the expression? Unless you have all your marbles. Where do these expressions come from? I have no idea. You have all your marbles. I don't know, what does that mean? If you don't have all your marbles, if you don't have your wits about you, if you don't have a fairly intelligent mind, some of the details and complexity of a text like this might not be appreciated by you. Who cares? Who cares? The truth that's being conveyed here by these teachings is actually an incredibly simple truth. What is a simple truth? You're not your body, mind, and senses. You are Satchidananda Atma. How complicated is that? If you can say it in one sentence, how complicated can it be? Who has to be a genius to understand something like that? The fundamental teachings are not complex. So it's not a matter of intelligence. It is a matter of thinking properly. It's a matter of, to use a casual English, getting it. And getting it means, we've had this discussion before, getting it means not listening. Remember this discussion long ago. Not listening like you used to listen when you were a college student. Remember this discussion? I think we had it here at maybe the second class or so. I think I observed that the skills you acquired in college can actually be an impediment to this kind of learning. An impediment because when you were in the college classroom, you were gathering information. And that orientation, gathering information, is the end of Vedanta. It destroys Vedanta. It turns Vedanta into just another ordinary subject matter, and it renders Vedanta impotent if you listen as you did when you were in college, listening for information. And we discussed, I think, in the first or second class, that this Vedantic teaching requires an utterly different kind of listening, an utterly different kind of perspective. With that kind of listening or perspective, then you really get it. And when you really get it, na samsrutihi. And if you listen like you did in college, asti chet, then that samsruti, then that worldly suffering continues. You go on gaining information. Now you've learned another text. You can add it to the list. I've studied the Bhagavad Gita. I've studied this text. I've studied the Katha Upanishad. I have to remember the text that we've taught recently. I've studied the Katha Upanishad. I've studied the Mundaka Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishad, this Upanishad, that Upanishad, this text, that text, whatever. And now I have studied Viveka Chudamani. Another ticket off. It's like you're working towards your college degree. You have so many credits to acquire. You're ticking off the credits. Well, when you tick off enough credits in college, they're going to give you a certificate. When you tick off enough credits here at this ashram, you don't get anything. Sorry, I hope you're not expecting anything. I don't think you are. It's not a matter of ticking off anything. Okay, enough said. Okay. So, all right. Let's move on. Oh, interesting to compare these two verses. The prior verse, which we just discussed, talked about the end of worldly suffering. The end of worldly suffering is jnana pala. It is the fruit of knowledge. This whole section we're studying now, last class, and I think even the class before that, the section is on jnana pala, the fruits of these teachings, the results of these teachings. You might remember when we studied the doctrine of karma that there are two kinds of pala, two kinds of result, and we call them drishta pala and adrishta pala. Drishta pala is a result that takes place now. The results of that action are immediate. The consequences are immediate. So then for this jnana, for gaining enlightenment, there should be drishtapala. What is the drishtapala? Well, the prior verse said it very clearly. Na samsrutihi yasya. For that person, worldly suffering comes to an end. That is the drishtapala. Now we might ask, what is the adrishtapala? Is there a drishtapala? If there is, what is it? And first of all, according to the doctrine of karma, there should be a drishtapala. For every kind of action, there are drishta and adrishtapala. Here, the action we're talking about, in a technical sense, is the action of the jnana vritti in your mind, the akhandakara vritti. Remember that complicated stuff? When that akhandakara vritti destroys ignorance, that happens to be a karma, an action. So for that action, the jnana, the akhandakara vritti destroying ignorance, for that action, there should be a drishtapala and an adrishtapala. The drishtapala is the end of worldly suffering. What is the adrishtapala? That'll be the next verse. Aham brahmeti vijnanat, aham brahmeti vijnanat. kalpa koti shatarjitam kalpa koti shatar sanchitam vilayam yati sanchitam vilayam prabodhat swapna karmavat prabodhat swapna aham brahma iti vijnanat vijnanat due to the knowledge as a result of the knowledge which knowledge aham brahma iti as a result of the knowledge that aham I am brahman with this knowledge what takes place as a result of this knowledge well we were starting to talk about karma in fact we're going to have quite a series of verses now talking about karma the relationship between this knowledge and karma do you remember what we called sanchita karma Sanchita karma is the accumulation of karmas over your prior lives. How many prior lives? Kalpa koti shata arjitam. This sanchita karma is arjita, it is collected over a long time. How many times? Kalpas, cycles of this universe. How many cycles of this universe? Koti shata, hundreds of billions of cycles of this universe. So all of that sanchita karma accumulated over countless prior lives, that sanchita karma, what happens to it? Vilayam yati. Vilayam, dissolution. Yati, it undergoes. It undergoes dissolution. How does it undergo dissolution? Vijnanat, due to gaining this knowledge, due to gaining this knowledge, I am Brahman, due to becoming enlightened, this sanchita karma, which is not small, Shankara really makes it big, this sanchita karma accumulated over countless prior lives, as much sanchita karma as it is possible to accumulate, all of it, vilayam yati, it undergoes dissolution. Prabodhat, due to enlightenment. When you are enlightened, vilayam yati, it undergoes dissolution. Prabodhat, due to enlightenment. And a wonderful metaphor here, swapna karma vat. We're going to discuss a little bit how does that take place. First of all, we're trying to understand the adrishta pala. The adrishta pala, if you remember, is a pala which occurs later. So the pala that occurs now, drishta pala, for the enlightened person, is freedom from suffering. This is the condition of being jivan mukta, being liberated while alive. But then the adrishta pala, the unseen result, means a result that will take place later, which means not in this life, means after this life comes to an end. So what is the adrishtapala for this enlightenment, which takes place not while you're alive, but when you're dead? Sanchitam vilayam yati. That sanchita karma undergoes dissolution, but understand what that's implying. Why do you get reincarnated? Why do you go from life to life to life to life? Because of sanchita karma. In the absence of sanchita karma, there is no reincarnation. This is the doctrine of karma. You are reincarnated due to sanchita karma. So then what the verse is saying is that due to this knowledge, there will be no rebirth. The absence of rebirth is adrishtapala, is it not? So the drishtapala is a state of being jivanmukta, enlightened while alive. The adrishtapala is the state of being videhamukta, enlightened, liberated while dead, is literally what it means, videhamukta. But what that means is not being reborn. And just to make it very clear, you might wonder, is not being reborn necessarily a good thing? You know, because we tend to think, especially most of us have fairly reasonable lives, and a lot of good things. We have some suffering, but a lot of good things happen to us. So it may lead us to conclude, well, wait a minute, rebirth isn't that bad. If my next birth could be as good as this life or maybe a little bit better, I'll sign up for it, you know. you might think like that. And it's actually a wrong notion, because the condition of enlightenment is a condition of being utterly non-separate from Brahman, which is a state of being utterly content, utterly fulfilled, in a state of perfection. You've had good days. Do any of your good days approach utter contentment and perfection? Doubtful, right? As good as a day could be, it's probably not utter contentment and perfection. This is the condition of an enlightened person, utter contentment and perfection, being non-separate from Brahman. So, any kind of rebirth, no matter how good it might be, is a giant step down from that condition of utter contentment. Certainly, if you understand, for the enlightened person, it's utter non-separation. The moment you have a body, there is apparent separation. As long as there's a body, there's going to be some degree of separation. So therefore, the most desirable condition is actually not Jivan Mukti. Not Jivan Mukti. In a state of Jivan Mukti, you still have a physical body. You still have something which, even though it doesn't truly cause separation, it causes apparent separation. And we'll talk about bodhita anuvritti a little bit later. We have to get time for that. So this body, remember, bodhita anuvritti, it continues, but you don't take it too seriously. It's just there as a body. But it's enough to cause an apparent separation. That apparent separation is a step down. So even the jivan mukta is stuck with a physical body and apparent separation. Only the Videha Mukti, the one who has dropped the physical body, is the one who achieves this absolute perfection. That state of absolute perfection is Videha Mukta, and it occurs in the absence of rebirth. And that's what's described here. There is Vilayam Yati Prabodhat, for one who gains enlightenment, this sanchita karma, vilayam yati, it undergoes dissolution and there is no rebirth. And Sri Shankara gives a nice metaphor here. Swapna karma vat. Just like the karmas you commit in your dream don't affect you. And here we have to illustrate. So he's giving the example, the karmas you do in a dream will not affect you, prabodhat, after you awake. After you wake, the karmas you commit in a dream won't affect you. No matter how big those karmas are, they won't affect you. Suppose in your dream, you murder someone. First degree murder, which can result, I think, in the state of New Jersey, in a life sentence in prison. You are sentenced to spend the rest of your life in prison, and in your dream, day after day, week after week, month after month, in this miserable, stinking prison, you're suffering, you're so miserable, all the other people around you are so miserable, it's all miserable, everything is miserable, year after year after year, and then you wake up. Now, when you wake up, what happened to the rest of your sentence? What do you mean, what happened to the rest? No sentence. You wake up, it's gone, it's over. No matter how long your punishment should have been, when you wake up from the dream, that sentence is utterly gone. All right. Now, We have just a few minutes left. I want to show you a problem here. There is an objection which can be raised. And the objection is this. When you wake up out of a dream, the dream world is utterly gone. When you wake up out of the sleep of ignorance, does this world go away? The world continues. And if you remember, the term we used for that is bodhita anuvritti. The world continues, but it is negated. Just like this pot. The pot is bodhita anuvritti. You know there's no pot. You know there's only clay. But there is the apparent continuation of pot. A pot which is negated in your understanding. Bodhita anuvritti. When you wake up out of the dream, it's gone. When you wake up out of the sleep of ignorance, this world continues. Presumably, the sanchita karma is part of this world. So then, when you wake up out of the sleep of ignorance and the world continues, bodhita anuvritti, then why shouldn't your sanchita karma continue in the same way? The dream goes away. But an enlightened person experiences a world, then why wouldn't the enlightened person also continue to experience the sanchita karma? It's part of the world, after all. Do you see? It's quite a good objection. And this is a style of Vedanta, by the way, to raise objections. And if I'm really doing a good job, I'm not sure I'm doing a good job. If I'm doing a good job, it should make you feel a little uncomfortable. Because, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. How can that be? How can you truly be free from sanchita karma? If sanchita karma is part of the law of the cosmos exists whether you're enlightened or not, unlike the dream world. So if the cosmos exists whether you're enlightened or not, and sanchita karma is part of that cosmos, how can you get free of sanchita karma? The cosmos goes on existing whether you're enlightened or not. Good, right? No, good means this is a significant objection and we better be ready to deal with it. And here's the answer. And it's going to be a little technical, not too much, but you'll follow it. In order to understand this, we really have to apply one of Shankara's most brilliant teachings, and that is the recognition of different levels of reality. We've used this material not in this class before, but in some of our other classes. You'll recognize this nomenclature. Satta means level of reality. There is a paramartika satta, which is the absolute reality. Paramartika satta means Brahman. Sarvam kalvidam Brahman. There is only Brahman. That is the expression of this paramartika satta. Then there is a vyavaharika satta. Vyavaharika satta, which is an empirical existence. Empirical existence means look around you. This is empirical existence. And then finally, there is a pratibhasika satta, which is a projected reality. In our example of the rope snake, the rope is vyavaharika. The snake is pratibhasika, projected by you. And of course, the rope is ultimately nothing but Brahman. If you say there is no rope, there's only Brahman, that's paramartika satta. If you say there is no snake, there's only a rope, that is vyavaharika satta. And if you say, watch out for the snake, that is pratibhasika satta. Now, what's significant is who dreams this stuff up? Who is the creator of each of these? Of course, for the absolute reality, uncreated. Brahman is Brahman. There's nothing to create Brahman, uncreated. On the other hand, we do have a creator for this vyavaharika satta, for this empirical world, and the creator is the one we call Ishvara, God. Ishvara is a creator of the world in which we live. Ishvara is a creator of a world in which plants grow, and the fibers from plants can be woven into ropes. So the rope being part of vyavaharika satta, if the rope is part of Ishvara's creation. Who created the snake? You did, Jiva. So the Jiva, the ignorant individual, is the one who creates pratibhasika satta. Now, this is just a little background. Now we're gonna go through this. Ignorance destroys what? Ignorance destroys what? Let's try that again. Knowledge destroys what? The short answer, of course, is knowledge destroys ignorance together with the effects of ignorance, right? So knowledge would destroy ignorance of the rope along with the effect of the ignorance, which is the snake. So ignorance destroys, knowledge destroys ignorance together with the effects of ignorance. So knowledge of the rope will destroy ignorance of the rope plus snake are both destroyed by ignorance. Does knowledge destroy the world? Knowledge can't destroy the world. Knowledge destroys what is born of ignorance. Your knowledge destroys what is born of your ignorance. And what is born of your ignorance is what is created by you. So your knowledge destroys what you create out of ignorance. Are you with me? Your knowledge destroys what you create out of ignorance. Your knowledge cannot destroy what ignorance creates with Maya. Ignorance with Maya creates this world. You don't have the capacity to destroy it. After you're enlightened, this world exists and continues to exist. This vyavaharika satta. But crucially, what is pratibhasika? What is your creation gets destroyed. Now, let's apply this principle now to what happens to karma. Sanchita karma, we could say, is part of this world. And as part of this world, your knowledge cannot destroy the sanchita karma. This was the objection. Knowledge destroys ignorance and its effects, but sanchita karma is not ignorance. And sanchita karma, the karmas which are remembered by the universe, waiting to take place, that's what these sanchita karmas are, right? What is sanchita karma? Your past actions, which are yet to receive the results, those pending results are remembered, as it were, by the cosmos, by the intelligence of the entire universe. The intelligence of the entire universe remembers, so to speak, that you have yet to receive a result for a particular action. This is all vyavaharika. How then can knowledge set us free from sanchitta? Some of you can answer this. We've had this discussion in other classes. And the answer is this. Sanchita karma belongs to whom? Sanchita karma belongs to the doer of the action. The karma phala belongs to the karma karta, to the doer of action. Whoever does the action owns the result. So this intelligence of universe is going to ensure that the doer of each action receives the appropriate results. Who is the doer of action? Well, in Sanskrit, the word doer of action is called karta. Karta. Karta is a word we literally means the agent of action, but it's also a word we use in Vedanta to describe the false sense of doership. Satchidananda Atma doesn't do anything, as we've discussed before. Satchidananda Atma is not teaching this class. Satchidananda Atma is not listening to this lecture. Then who is the karta? The karta, the agent of action, is something we create out of ignorance. Ego, sense of doership, sense of enjoyership, all of this is created in our minds due to ignorance, means I find myself to be an agent of action because of ignorance of my true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Failing to know my true nature as Satchidananda Atma, I think, oh, I am Swami Tadatmananda giving this lecture, for example. But suppose I discover I'm not Satchidananda. Suppose I am not Swami Tadatmananda giving this lecture. Suppose I know I am Satchidananda Atma and I'm not giving this lecture. In which case, the karta is destroyed by knowledge. And the karta can be destroyed by knowledge because a karta is a result of ignorance. Ignorance gives rise to the karta. Just like ignorance of the snake, ignorance of the rope, gives rise to the snake, ignorance of Satchidananda Atma gives rise to the karta. When you destroy ignorance about the rope, the snake goes away. When you destroy ignorance about Atma, the karta goes away. The karta can go away because the karta is not vyavaharika. The karta is pratibhasika, your creation out of ignorance. It can and does get destroyed. And when that karta does get destroyed, again, knowledge destroys ignorance about Atma. And when ignorance about Atma is destroyed, any result of ignorance of Atma also gets destroyed, karta being the result. So with this knowledge, the karta is destroyed, which is destroyable. Sanchita karma perhaps is not destroyable, being part of vyavaharika satta, but the karta, being pratibhasika, being your creation due to ignorance, it is capable of being destroyed. And when that karta is destroyed, the karta is the owner of the sanchita karma. If there is no ownership of the sanchita karma, vilayam yati, it undergoes dissolution. There's no one to collect the sanchita karma. The universe remembers the sanchita. There's no one around to collect it. So I suppose we could say, if there's no one around to collect it, then the universe forgets. If there's no one to collect your sanchita karma, if the karta is destroyed, there's no one available to collect your sanchita karma, so why should the universe remember? The universe forgets, so to speak. Vilayam yati. So this is the answer to the question. Notice it was a pretty stiff challenge, but Vedanta can withstand any kind of challenge. So we need to understand very clearly how it is that we become free from reincarnation. And it's not by having karmas destroyed, but rather by destroying the karta, the ownership of that karma. Okay, enough for today. We'll continue in our
Next class.
Oh.